This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Kat Murty. She's a social media marvel who breaks all kinds of molds when it comes to the libertarian movement. For starters, she's a woman, and a feminist, and a person of color. We're going to talk about her day job at the Cato Institute, her work at Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, and the group she co-founded, which is called Feminists for Liberty. And we're going to discuss why both women and millennials and people of color should not simply be part of the libertarian movement, but probably leading it. Kat Murty, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, you're extremely welcome. Your social media cred precedes you. Your Twitter bio reads, at the beginning, it says libertarian, feminist. I know a lot of people who'd say there's a contradiction there. What do you think? Is there a contradiction between being a libertarian and a feminist?
No, I don't think there's a contradiction at all. I think that the core goal of both libertarianism and feminism is fundamentally to allow individuals to make their own life decisions, to pursue whatever life that they see best for them without having the state or any other coercive power forcing them into a particular role.
So before we move on, what are the other coercive forces in society? Because this is, a lot of libertarians, and particularly, while you are a millennial and I am actually a late baby boomer, so there's a lot of gap between us. A lot of libertarians, let's say I'll be generous and say who are older than me, will only cop to the idea that, the only really coercive organization in society is the state because they have men with guns, et cetera. What are the other coercive parts of society?
Well, I do think that it's true that the state is certainly the most coercive of any type of organization in society. And I don't think that it's true that we could at any point eliminate all coercion in our society. But yes, of course, you can have non-state actors that still wield coercive power. Mm-hmm. What's important is that people are able to opt in or opt out of those systems and that they're not forced into a system that they don't want to take part of that doesn't work best for them.
So would, it's a kind of looser affiliation or force in society, but would you say racism is a coercive force or sexism or corporations?
I think that all of these things can be used, can be wielded by a coercive force.
Right.
When it comes to things like sexism, racism, I would certainly say that they're a form of collectivism. But it's not a core, and it's something that someone with coercive force can then wield to take away someone's liberty. But in and of themselves, I wouldn't call them coercive forces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The goals for a libertarian feminism is, or the main goal is to allow women to have unfettered choices or choices that are free of coercion.
True, but I wouldn't say it's just women. It's for people of all genders. It's very much the case that our government treats people of different genders differently in our legal system, and we want everyone to access the same amount of choice regardless of gender. And it's also the case that women, for the most part, feminism is aimed towards them because women were held down by society, and specifically with the power of government, for generations and generations and centuries. And so the feminist movement sort of arose from that. But that doesn't mean that it's limited to just women's empowerment or women's freedom.
Mm-hmm. What are the ways in which the government or governments still discriminate against women?
There's any number of different things. The most obvious one that was discussed a lot recently has been the military service, where, I'm a libertarian. I'm personally an anarchist. And so I think it would be great if we had a much smaller or no military. But that said, the fact that certain roles are prescribed only for men, women are not allowed to hold them, or in other areas, the way that family law is structured very much discriminates by men versus women. there's just across the patchwork of society, you'll start to see ways in which someone's sex or someone's gender changes the way in which they're viewed. And that's just the hard and fast discrimination. I think that you'll also see a lot of discrimination that comes about as a result of people just holding ideas, not realizing that they're not equal in the way that they're enforcing a law or something like that. And then, of course, the most obvious, perhaps, would be the ones that actually have laws to do with your body, whether that's around reproductive rights or whether that's something like, for instance, the parenthood amendments and how that treats parenting people, or whether that's government prescriptions that require that everyone fit very neatly into a male or female box, whether or not that actually reflects who they are as a person. They're very wide ranging.
Well, and you in the homepage for Feminists for Liberty, kind of your mission statement is anti-sexism and anti-statism, pro-markets and pro-choice. Join us in fomenting an all-gender, anti-carceral, freedom-friendly feminist movement. Talk about the carceral part. What do you mean by that, and why is that so important?
Yes, definitely. So that was a big frustration with certain segments of the feminist movement have unfortunately sort of attempted to pursue a less sexist society by really bringing in the state, bringing in specifically criminal law. And so one way in which we see this happen a lot is folks who believe that sex work is inherently inherently anti-woman, and therefore it should be closely policed. And of course, you know, besides the fact that sex work is fundamentally work, when you're throwing people in prison for, you know, for engaging in a consensual activity like that, you're making their life harder. People who are being primarily targeted are women. And, you know, the people who are in a bad situation, who are actually being sexually trafficked or something like that, are not able to find help. And that's just one example. But there have been numerous ways where, unfortunately, the impulse towards a less sexist society has been kind of pushed through this criminal justice lens in a way that ends up hurting not just women, but all of society. Another one that I sort of mentioned earlier has been a lot of the attempts around personhood amendments. And we hear about these in the context of abortion a lot, but they actually also are extremely important when you start looking at drug policy, because this creates situations where, for instance, women or pregnant people who miscarry can be held liable for manslaughter, murder, et cetera, if, for instance, they test positive for having had a drink, or they test positive for having had some sort of illegal substance in their body, even if they had asked for help. And you have all these cases where folks are saying, I found out I was pregnant, I need to get off of this drug, I want help, I want to go into substance abuse counseling, I want to be able to overcome this so that I'm able to be sober throughout my pregnancy. And the immediate response is a carceral one, to throw them in prison, and not, hey, how can we actually help you? And so we're very much against that. Mm-hmm. We don't think that the state really in any matter helps free people. That's why we're anti-sexism and anti-statism. We think that the two of those are some of the biggest threats on our society.
Personhood amendments, I mean, that's you're pro-choice or pro-abortion from, the moment of conception. And, you know, that's despite the, I think, certitude that a lot of, pro-life people talk about. It's not always clear what that means, but you're from the moment of conception.
It's not always clear, yeah.
Right. From the moment of conception to, birth.
Well, I don't know if I can draw a clear line, honestly. And I would say about my own views, I don't consider myself pro-abortion at all. I do consider myself pro-choice because you're right. It's not really clear where that line lies. I mean, I would think that if there were to be a line, it should be closer to viability. But What that means, obviously, is very different. And if you start looking, especially at these late-term abortions, which is what you hear about a lot, most of the time, these were wanted babies where there's just something seriously wrong and the life of the baby, the life of the mother is at threat.
And I'm actually talking to you from Ohio, where I live half the time. And in December of 2017, Ohio passed a law that essentially said that you couldn't abort a fetus if you found out it had Down syndrome. That would be a state incursion against female liberty.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I understand certainly where the feelings for this come from. I mean, but I think that that's really big on why it's important that we have these discussions as a cultural discussion and not as a legal discussion. There's a big difference between trying to encourage other people, hey, you know, people with Down syndrome are still people. Maybe it's valuable to allow them to live, to treat them as equal people, versus saying, if you do this, we will lock you in a box for murder, potentially for life, right?
Here's an odd question. What's in it for men to become feminists? Because, you know, and if the standard feminist narrative, which I think has broken down certainly over my lifetime, and I think about the position of women in general and the status of women, say, from the 70s until now, it's vastly improved. There are still areas of real inequality that are, you know, are troubling, but it's much better. But what's in it for men to live in a world, in a feminist world?
Well, honestly, I think it's good for everyone to live in a feminist world. I do want to push back on that idea that everything has to be in it for men, for women, for anything. Mm-hmm. But just beyond that, let's go ahead.
Well,
and answer
you know
question.
What I'm saying by that is that I can remember, and I, you know, there were moments in the 70s where, you know, like the old patriarchy was kind of hanging on. And as a kid, I didn't understand why. As I got older, it's like if you're in a world where you can be kind of dim and kind of dull, but because you're not actually competing against smart women, you can do well. Women in general have to obey you, and they show deference to you, and you have more status. I understand in retrospect why, you know, whether it was Norman Mailer or William Buckley, you know, on the right or the left, like they hated feminism because they didn't, you know, they benefited from the status quo. And there's still, you know, a fair amount of that around. So, you know, kind of what's in it for men to say, you know what, I'm going to live in a world that is more equal towards women. You know, what's in it for us, I guess?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning it's not just for women. This kind of equality, freeing people for gender roles, that's good for everybody. You know, there's been a lot of studies that have shown that more economic liberty is not just good for society as a whole. It's specifically the most good for women and for the poorest of people. So that's just one example of how policies that do free people to, you know, pursue their greater good is good for everybody. But also worth mentioning, there's many ways in which the patriarchy, since you brought it up, has really hurt men. You know, if we start looking at things like men have much higher suicide rates, men, especially older men, tend to be more depressed than women. And you look at why, and a lot of it is tied to the fact that, you know, there's the cultural norm that they're not allowed to express emotions. There's cultural norms that keep them from having very close relationships. That is one of the best reasons, one of the closest correlated reasons for why people don't commit suicide, why people have longer lifestyles. There's also the fact that men should be able to pursue the roles that are best suited for them. And whether that's whether that means that they want to be in a high power career, or if perhaps it suits them better to be a homemaker, working while their spouse is out and about as the breadwinner, or whether there's something in between that. I think that there's many ways in which society could really open up for men's liberty as well. And, you know, and you do run into men all the time who maybe want to pursue a job in nursing, or they'd like to spend more time around their family, or you know, they have these values as well. And society holding them back from that is not good for men any more than society telling women that they have to stay at home in their kitchen with a baby on their hip is good for women. And when you really look at that larger picture, too, a society where we're allowing everybody to advance as much as they can, where we're allowing everybody to move forward, to contribute, is a better society. If we look at the centuries upon centuries where women and people of color were held back, where they weren't allowed to invent, they weren't allowed to be scientists, they weren't allowed to be mathematicians, they weren't think about all of the contributions that could have happened if they had been allowed to actually engage in a way that they weren't, and how much farther our society could be.
Well, that's the whole question of Judith Shakespeare, right, in Virginia Woolf's Room of One's Own.
Right.
You know, Shakespeare, you know, what did we lose by not having, creating a world in which Shakespeare's sister could also be the Bard of Avon? I think it's a powerful argument and way to look at it. What do you do in Feminists for Liberty? What are the activities I do? I know that you and one of my recent colleagues, Elizabeth Nolan Brown, went to the recent Women's March, and you had some great signs. You were quoted in a couple of newspaper accounts. But what do Feminists for Liberty do?
So we're really focusing on changing the discussion around feminism and about libertarianism. So that's kind of where it happens. So that's a matter of being present in the libertarian movement and talking about feminism and bringing up feminist perspectives and defending this sort of like anti-state, anti-sexist perspective that we have. It's also a matter of being present in the feminist community and bringing up how markets help women, how liberty is fundamentally a feminist value, or rather the other way around, how feminism is fundamentally a part of liberty.
And by feminism and then, here, you're essentially, in a way, you're saying that everybody should be treated equally under the law. But
law, I think that so I like the definition of feminism that feminism is the social, political, and cultural equality of the genders. So when I say that, I don't mean it in the sort of equality of outcome idea where everybody at the end of the day needs to have the exact same set of things. It's more of everyone should have an equal right to pursue whatever their goals might be, provided that they're not obviously preventing someone else from doing that, coercing someone else.
So can I ask you, and this is betraying my academic pursuits from a couple of lifetimes ago, but then are you, and I'm not even sure if feminists really talk this way anymore, but are you an essentialist or a non-essentialist? Do you believe that women, by dint of whether it's their cultural upbringing or their biological makeup or a mix of the two, that there is something, you know, that women have a different perception of the world than men, and that men, because of the same kind of biological dictates and whatnot, that we, you know, and it doesn't mean that we can't get along, but that there's something essential to female identity or gender that is distinct from male or not? And does that matter, I guess?
So I have to tell you, I look at this as an individualist. And do I think that there is some collection of ideas, of experiences, of thoughts, et cetera, that might be described as the male experience or the female experience or men's experience versus women's experience? Yes, probably. But do I think that you could actually take that idea and then superimpose it upon an individual and say, here is your view, what you've experienced? No, I don't think that you can. And so at Feminists for Liberty, we're very focused on removing that collectivism of looking at people as their gender or as their sex.
Right.
A value. I mean, people do experience things because of their sex, because of their gender, that, yes, obviously do change the way in which they view the world. That might even change some of their abilities within the world. But that is not the same within those cases. I mean, if you talk to one woman versus another woman, their experiences are not going to be the same. And even their physical experiences of the world will not be the same.
Well, and this is where intersectionality gets a hard knock from most libertarians and certainly conservatives, it seems. And intersectionality being the idea that no one, as I understand it, and I tend to agree with it, at least in this definition, that intersectionality holds that no single aspect or facet of a person fully defines them. So, being a woman is meaningful, but so is, being of Asian Indian descent, as you are, or being white versus brown, being rich versus poor, that all of these things kind of add up to define you.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I actually think that if you go back and you read Kimberly Williams Crenshaw's original essays on this, and she's given TED Talks, she's done a lot of this, and she's the founder of this idea of intersectionality, I think it actually is a fairly libertarian perspective. It's talking about how, let's say that you care about diversity. She's really responding to people who say that they care about diversity and then say things like, oh, well, because this helps some women, it's good for all women. And you're missing a lot of that picture if you say that all women are the same. So this thing is good for women, therefore it's good for all women, because you've missed, what about the black woman? What about the trans woman? Like, their needs, their understandings are very different. And I think that intersectionality fundamentally is really about coming down to the individual and understanding that people are not just one aspect of their identity. What they are instead is a really complicated calico map of various intersecting identities. So yes, you're right. I'm Indian. I'm a woman. I'm a feminist. I'm a libertarian.
You're from Texas.
I'm from Texas.
Yeah, this is it's getting worse as you add new elements.
Right. But so, I mean, all of those things make me very different. You can't just like say, oh, I'm an Indian, therefore I'm like every other Indian, or I'm a libertarian, therefore I have the same views as every other libertarian, as I think any libertarian out there knows is not true.
So how has the reception been for Feminists for Liberty in what let's call it the conventional or the traditional feminist movement? Because it seems that There are individualist feminists. There are free market feminists, but a lot of the times it seems like it fits more neatly into a kind of progressive ideology.
Yeah, certainly. So part of the catalyst for starting Feminists for Liberty was really the fact that every time we saw feminism discussed in the media, particularly with the onset of the 2016 primaries, we only heard about feminism from this very left-wing perspective. And of course, feminism is not a left-wing economic system. One, feminism, two, is not a branch of the Democratic Party. And three, this view of looking at women as a solid voting bloc that all have the same interests, that have the same views on everything, is fundamentally anti-feminist. It's just putting women back into this gender or sex-based category and saying that they all have the same needs and the same interests and the same thoughts. And it's dehumanizing.
It's what do you make of the, according to exit polls, women overall voted for Hillary Clinton or voted for the Democratic candidate, but white women voted for Donald Trump. That plays into your idea that they have different, to the extent that you're focusing on women's experience, they have different preferences.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's something that needs to be addressed. Even then, you can't look at every white woman and say, oh, you clearly voted for Trump, because that you would still be wrong in that picture. But I think that it's true. Our common way of looking at it lacks nuance. And I think that part of that has been a very active movement to kind of erase sort of this nuance for political needs. And so I think that while on the whole, most feminists that I've talked to have been very open to our ideas, a lot of them have been very interested in our perspective, you do get some folks who are hostile, who, honestly, including folks, in the social media world, who have automatically blocked our Twitter account, blocked my Twitter account, blocked Elizabeth's Twitter account without us ever engaging with them, where we've only found out when we wanted to share an article that they wrote that we appreciated, because they see it as, oh no, these people aren't pushing this socialist democratic ticket, therefore they can't be feminists. And I think that that's a small minority, just as there's a small minority within the libertarian movement who say, oh no, these people want to talk about sexism. These people have these views about individual rights and how individual rights matter within sex politics and gender politics. Therefore, they're automatically not libertarians, which I think in both it's a conflation. And in sometimes it's a very artfully done conflation in order to erase a perspective that challenges your worldview.
Yeah. How have you been accepted in within the kind of broad-based libertarian movement? And, you know, I get, and I say this as somebody, I've been a professional libertarian since 93, and it's clear that there are more women involved in the movement. I know Reason has always had three of the last five editors in chief of Reason magazine have been women. But there's, you know, a clear gender disparity. You know, what will it take for women to become more comfortable in the libertarian movement?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been I've self-identified as a libertarian for about the last 15 years, and I've been actively involved in the movement for about the last 10 of those. And I can tell you just within that period of time, I've seen so many more women, particularly young women, millennials and even younger, probably some, I guess they're calling them Gen Z now, who increasingly you're seeing those people attracted to the movement. And so I do think that part of that is just overall shifting from traditional two-party system to more and more people realizing they're independent and exploring ideas. And part of that's that the ideas are available on the internet. But you're right. I also do routinely meet so many people who say, yes, I'm a libertarian, or yes, I hold these views, but I don't want to be part of the movement anymore because of sexism that I ran into in that movement. And I think that that's something that thankfully is changing, in part because these are just views that are changing across our society as a whole. They're also something that's been really actively happening within the libertarian movement, where people really are trying to say, hey, you can't use libertarianism as a cover for your sexist views or your racist views in a way that was much more acceptable, I think, when libertarianism was a younger movement, or at least was treated more acceptably. But yeah, fundamentally, I think that as long as you have people, and, you know, we've been attacked before on this, where, you know, if we have outreach directors, for instance, for libertarian movements who in a discussion about why there's not more women in the libertarian movement will make jokes about things. And we've all heard this joke. It's not funny anymore. But, you know, women have a role in the libertarian movement. They should be making sandwiches for all the real libertarians. And then when we, when Elizabeth had called that out, Elizabeth Nolan Brown, your coworker, my co-founder, when she'd called that out, we had a huge outrage from folks saying, you know, you're anti-free speech. It's wrong to retweet someone because you disagree with them, which is, of course, a fundamental misunderstanding of free speech. Criticizing
and of
someone
Twitter,
else's free
actually,
speech is
as
not
well. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. The idea that you can only retweet someone because you agree with them and you think that they're right is very different from how it actually works. And we all know this. But I do think that when you have these fights and you have people, and, you know, that individual in particular had actually followed up with a long Facebook rant about this was exactly why there shouldn't be women in the libertarian movement, because women don't value liberty, because it chases away young men, et cetera, which I think is just false. but yeah, I mean, when you get a discussion like this and the default is immediately to say, no, you need to protect this young man because he said this. I mean, I think that those kind of pressures do chase away women. And people will say, well, if they held these beliefs deeply, they would be fine with that. They could just put up with it, you know, turn the other cheek, et cetera. And I think that might be the case for some people, but particularly as a movement where we want more people to be libertarian, we want to attract people. And when people first start looking into the ideas, and unfortunately they have to wade through certain segments, particularly online. And I do want to note that a lot of these segments are, and in some cases have actually said that they're recruiting tools for the alt-right, who are using the ideas of liberty to bring people to the alt-right. They're not actually libertarian. Nonetheless, when the first thing that they see, they look up something with liberty in the name, and then they see a bunch of sexist jokes and stuff about why women don't have a place in the movement, that's not exactly going to make them think, oh, here, I found my way home.
What do you think of, James Damore, who was the Google employee? He was fired after circulating in-house a memo at Google that then came out, criticizing Google's diversity attempts to increase the diversity of its workforce. And he essentially argued in sometimes nuanced, sometimes not, that different groups of people, whether it's women or minorities, have different interests and different abilities. And that more than anything explained why Google engineers were overwhelmingly white guys like him. And I'm asking this within the libertarian movement, there seems to be a tension between people who are like, oh, well, you know what, we've got to deal with facts. And, these are the facts. And then there are people who are like, you know what, I want to treat people like individuals. Is that intention? And do you do with that?
Well, I'm actually glad you framed it in that way. So this is actually a really interesting case, and I think it's one where you really need to look at it with nuance that gets erased in the social media, dogpiling that happens with any of these cases. And so, I saw this coming out. I happened to be waiting for a flight. I had a lot of time, so I read the whole memo right as the stuff started happening around it. And then I read all the reactions. And I think that James Damore is wrong. He is a biological essentialist, as you brought up earlier. He has a lot of views that I think are just factually inaccurate, although, yes, he does draw them from statistics. As they say, lies, and damn statistics. It's one of those situations where, yes, you can say that, but you're missing part of the picture. And I think it's similar to folks who say things like, well, if women are just as smart as men, how come most of our scientists and engineers throughout society have been men? Well, because women weren't allowed to participate.
There was Marie Curie. So, anybody right. could have done it because she obviously wasn't very smart anyway. So, because
right. clearly,
she's a woman, right?
That's yeah. the situation, right?
No, that's and also so the paucity of great African-American writers or inventors of, say, up to 1860, yeah.
Exactly.
Obviously they just weren't trying very hard, right? There couldn't be
Why
any
on
other
earth
explanation.
Were slaves who weren't allowed to read or write by law not writing great works of fiction? Huh, well, I wonder.
And having said that, it's also true. You said that you're not as interested in equality of outcome as you are in equality of opportunity. But then do we get to, and this may be going off into philosophy land, which is a place I try not to visit, especially in the middle of the week. But, how do we know if, absent outcomes, how do we know that people are actually being given equal shots?
Well, so I think that that's actually a really good question, and it's a hard one to answer. I do think that there is some level of having to look at the outcomes, and it's not because the outcome is the goal. We're not trying to say we want everything in society to be 50% to be reflective of the demographics of society, right? Just because you have, 51% of the U.S., U.S. demographics are women doesn't mean that 51% of every single thing should be done by women. But I think certainly it's also a question when you start to ask, okay, but why is there such a big difference in this arena? And I think that that kind of brings you back into looking like, okay, let's look at specifically what's happening. And I think one sort of tangible place where this happens is with the gender wage gap. And, you know, the gender wage gap is one of these things that's become a very politicized discussion that really goes into, on the one half, saying a bunch of people saying there's no such thing. And the other half, people saying not only is there such thing, it applies to everybody. And it's specifically based on people being sexist, hiring managers being sexist and saying, you know, I'm only going to pay women 72% of the dollar. Now, that's not what's happening on either case. There is a gender wage gap. It does exist. And it doesn't all go one way. For instance, I think it's really interesting in many, if not most, of the urban centers in this country, millennial women who are unmarried and don't have children make significantly more than their male peers. That's a really interesting point that needs to be looked into more.
What is the explanation for that?
Well, so that's what I'm getting to. Yeah. So that's what I think is, that's where you start looking at it and you're like, oh, so maybe it's not sexism. Maybe it's more of a situation of what is it specifically about living in an urban center? What is it about getting married? What is it about children, having children that are impacting this? And why is that the big difference? And so I think when you start looking at that, that's when you start getting in the picture. And I'm not sure that we have a clear picture, but I think that there's a number of different factors around those three things that really change what we're looking at. And again, is the answer then, okay, so we need to make it so that all women live in cities and are college educated and don't get married and don't have children, and then we'll solve the wage gap? Well, no. One, because you've created a wage gap the other way. Two, not everyone wants that life. And three, you know, you haven't actually looked at the root problem here, which is, what is it about those three specific things that is creating the problem? I mean, it's the same way you have another wage gap in a lot of the, which also a wage gap that works in this way with women are making more in some of the smaller, like these old steel towns and mining towns and things like that, where increasingly more and more men are unemployed and at home. But what's interesting about them is that where you see unemployed women usually stay home, they're involved in their communities, they volunteer more, they do more childcare, et cetera, these men aren't. And so there's a big problem happening there around radicalization, increased suicides, increased substance abuse problems, all of that. So I think that you really have to look at these granular issues and try to figure out what's happening there and figure out not how can we fix this, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, but rather what can we do to remove the external pressures? What can we do so that people are able to approach this outside of that? What can we do? And a lot of times from a cultural perspective, not a governmental perspective, to have it be so that people are able to pursue the life that's best for them as an individual.
Yeah. There is also at least a third kind of issue in wage gaps too, that sometimes fields that become dominated by either men or women start to see wages increase or decrease. So that when you look at science fields or medicine, things like pediatrics tends to pay less than general practitioners, which pay less than something else. So, I mean, it's a multifaceted issue, and it's clear that a lot of the, you know, the most kind of global 30,000 foot, you know, view from 30,000 feet don't get to it. What about, you know, to slide a little bit from millennial or from gender to millennials, do you think, and obviously you've only grown up as a millennial, but do you think that there are millennials, and I, you know, I hasten to underscore that, you know, I'm doing this with, you know, kind of quote marks around everything, but is there, are millennials more individualistic or more communitarian than previous generations in your experience? And does that lend them towards an embrace of libertarianism or a rejection of it? Because, you know, and I, Emily Both. Eakins, the polling director at Cato, who
I
used to work at Reason,
yep.
I mean, it's, you know, she's done fantastic work, which kind of shows that millennials definitely, the one thing you can say, I was going to say they're all over the place. I think a better way of putting it is that a lot of generational attitudes among millennials don't map onto you know, what came before, whether in Gen X or in the baby boom. Are millennials proto-libertarians?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. I'm glad you brought up Emily's research as well, because I wanted to reference that. And you asked me, are millennials more communitarian or individualistic? Are they more libertarian or anti-liberty? And I think the answer is both. And why are they so different from previous generations? I think that what the thing you have to look at is the advent of the internet age. And something that really came up, you know, when I was a kid, of course, the internet had been around since the 70s, but that big change really happened starting in the early 90s and then really around the turn of the century. And that's completely changed the way that people view the world. And so are they more individualistic? Yes, they are. They're now able to online go on there, pursue things. We're no longer in a situation where you know whoever's in your town and that's it, you're stuck. People can go out there, they can research so much more. There's a wide, there's so much information out there. There's so many ways to go out there and say, oh, there are other people like me. I don't have to change myself into a person that I don't like because that's the only thing that people around me accept. I can find a community online. And so that, in a way, has also made them more community-oriented. Whether it's finding communities online or whether it's just realizing, you know, how small our very big world is and how many similarities there are everywhere around the world that have kind of given people this community mindset. In the same way, I mean, are millennials libertarian or anti-liberty? Again, both. Emily Eakins, she did a really interesting study, I thought, where she's done a few of these around millennials and their views of communism. And the one in particular that I want to call out is one where if you ask millennials their views of communism, they're generally favorable. And then if you start asking them questions without using the words capitalism or communism, which they generally disfavor and favor if you start describing these things, they don't favor communism.
Right. They like profits. They think, you know, business is kind
like
of profits, good.
Yeah. They like the idea of starting businesses, particularly, again, you got to bring it back to the internet age when these are people who've grown up around the idea of startups, who's grown up around the idea of creating an app in your free time, who have come up with the idea of, yes, you can have that Etsy business. Yes, you can do this. Yes, you can do that. They're not viewing that as capitalism. They're not even viewing, you know, someone throwing up a Kickstarter because they want to start their new business. That's seed funding. That's right. Like fundamental capitalist economics. But they're still seeing that. They see that and they're like, oh, yes, this is great. This is communism. This is people helping each other. And so that's how they're viewing it. And so I think that there's a big communications gap, really, in the liberty movement, where we need to be talking about these things and talking about, hey, all of these impulses, the things you like, the idea that, like, yes, you should get to be you. You should get to live the life you want, love the person you love, live where you want, have your tiny house if you want to. You should do all of this. And
well,
yes,
you know
you
what?
I
think you're talking crazy. I think you're talking crazy. And if I don't get to berate younger people as snowflakes, you know, what's the point of being older? I just don't understand.
Takes all the fun out of it.
Well, okay. So you're making a pretty strong case for, you know, both obviously for feminism as well as kind of millennialism in, you know, in the libertarian movement and why there's overlap. I want to talk a little bit about your work with drug policy. You were part, and I think you're an emeritus board member of Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, which has been around for a bit more than a decade. Has done great work to kind of bring, you know, a legitimate cost-benefit analysis to, you know, to students so that they understand better the ridiculous costs of drug prohibition. As well as making moral arguments. And we, you know, just as we live in a networked age now when people can be more themselves, we also are much more comfortable using drugs and pharmaceuticals to change our behavior, literally and figuratively, to change our minds, to modulate our moods, our energy levels. But here's my question for you, because that all fits into everything you're talking about. Why are millennials using drugs at such lower rates than baby boomers? I mean, what is wrong with you people?
Well, and even that, there's a big difference between the older millennials, which I think I'm one of, the younger millennials, and then you start getting into Gen Z.
Gen Z. Don't even get me started on them. I hate them.
Yeah, they're using them at the lowest rates. Yeah. They're using them at the lowest rates. They're having sex way less than anybody else.
Granted, they're also only like 21, right, or something. So, you know, they've got time to grow.
True. And they might change. They might change. Obviously, they've got lifetimes ahead of them. But just if you look at them contemporaneously with individuals of previous generations at the same age, they're generally speaking a lot less sexually and I guess I don't even know how you'd put it.
Psychoactive. Sexually and psychoactive. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And, you know, I think that there's a bunch of different things. In part, certainly it's the fact, and we saw this in other countries. It's been seen in Portugal. It's been seen in the Netherlands. So it's and it's worth mentioning that was in previous generations. So it's not just an issue of our times, because when drugs get legalized, the sort of mystery around them and the fact that it's badass and it makes you cool sort of disappears in a certain way. And so you just, the fact that it's no longer as mysterious, the fact that it's not like this, that it's not, that you've in some ways gotten rid of the stigma has actually also reduced usage. And of course, there's also the manner of, you know, when people feel safe to ask for help when they do have a substance abuse problem, they're more likely to, and they use them less. There's also more information about harm reduction and how to use drugs in a way and how to have sex in a way that's less likely to get you in trouble. But, you know, honestly, you've talked with Lenore Skenazy on this podcast before. She started Free Range Kids. And this is my own personal theory that I sort of thought of a little bit. But the fact that kids now are so much more sheltered, that they're less able to do things. I mean, I remember my first job, I started nannying when I was 12. And nowadays, I think in a lot of places, they actually expect you to have a nanny for a 12-year-old. And so, you know, they're not doing those things because their adulthood is being delayed in a very real way. And then again, just to bring it back to the internet, the other potential hypothesis is just the fact that, yeah, they can hang out with their friends in a chat room online. And to couple that with that, their parents don't feel comfortable with them going out by themselves. So they're hanging out on their phones. They're not going out. They're not going to that, house show. They're not going to go hang out, in the creek bed, or you can tell what I was doing when I was a teenager.
The back alley, the pool hall. Right, I mean, pool halls now are, you know, upscale events. Yeah.
So I think it's just a matter of delayed experimentation, although that's something that we'll see. Certainly, as they continue to grow up.
It's fascinating to think about, and I say this, I have a son who is 23 as well as one who's 16, and I know my father, just to keep it in kind of gender-specific terms, although it applies equally to my mother, but my father was born in 1923, and he lived through the Depression, started earning money when he was 12 or 13 to give to his family, fought in World War II by the time he was 21. I was born in 63. I started my career realistically, when I turned about 30, because I went to school much longer than my parents did. My kids clearly are, you know, they're more affluent at their age than I was, and they're delaying. You know, I mean, this is, it's kind of a luxury good that as we get wealthier, we, you know,
we're not getting married at 14 either. So.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, but the good thing about getting married at 14 is that you can get divorced by the time you're 18. So it's,
I have lots of friends who fell in that boat. So, yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you, and this will, just to kind of close things out, because this also goes to questions of, I think, of a broad libertarian mindset, which is, you know, simultaneously very individualistic, but then sometimes wants to defend traditional kind of social and cultural mores, you know, and it's a balancing act. And I think those of us in the libertarian movement tend to be more towards one or the other, you know, and we, you know, from a Hayekian view, the idea that certain social attitudes and temperaments and organizations persist because, you know, they've proven useful or not. You know, I mean, for me, it's I tend much more to the kind of radical individualist experimentalist end of things. But one of the places you see that, and it intersects with contemporary politics, is that people say, you know, I am an individualist or I'm a globalist, but I'm also a nationalist or a localist. You have an interesting background in that you are both Indian, Asian Indian or South Asian Indian, as well as you grew up in Texas. And those seem to be very radically different places. And in a certain way, you're exemplary, and I hesitate to say anybody is, you know, the perfect example of anything because it puts a lot of pressure on you, Kat, so just don't, you know, screw up. But, you know, you're both a globalist, you know, but then you're also an individual in a particular locale and time and place. You know, how do you square that? It seems very millennial to me. To be a person who can be both.
I think it is very millennial, and I think that that's something that's increasingly happening. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm going to bring it back to politics, but one of the big things that happened with this past election was that you had all these people saying, how the hell did Trump get to be president? No one I knew voted for him. And first off, I don't think that that's true. I think you had a bit of a reverse Bradley effect happening there. But,
And the Bradley effect, the Bradley effect is being people not admitting that they were voting for somebody they were going to vote for. Is that right?
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Precisely. Yeah. Yeah. So I do think that some of that happened. But then another part of it was that a lot of the people doing the commentary, people like us, you know, most of the people we know don't live where they were born. They have moved. We know people who are immigrants. We know people from all over the place. You know, I grew up between two countries. And so that really does change.
Well, and if we're being honest, three, because Texas, and I've lived there for a couple of years, they consider themselves a different country within the United States as well.
Yes, the Independent Republic of Texas. I have a shirt with that on it.
Yes.
But yeah, you're right. And so you create the situation where people forget that the vast majority of people, I think it's about 3% of the world's population, live in a different country than they were born in. And the vast majority of people everywhere in the world, but including the US, live within 50 miles of their hometown. And so you still do have that. But I think that that's increasingly changing. You know, especially with millennials, more and more are moving into big cities. More and more, they're going to college where they're getting experience with programs like study abroad programs. They're on the internet. They're making friends with people around the world. And so I think that we're kind of in this area of cultural shift where that's going to be happening. And at the same time, people are also looking back and saying, like, we're losing some traditions of my culture, whatever my culture might be. And that might be I'm Texan. It might be that I'm Indian. It might be, I don't know, the culture of your particular small town that you grew up in. We're losing certain elements. We want to cling to those. And I think that that's something that really it's like shifting diamonds from the sand. And as different people are going through and they've got these intersecting aspects of their own experience in the world, they're going to start to see what things they want to keep and what things they're filtering through. And, you know, that's the beauty of liberty.
Well, we will leave it there, Kat Murty. I think it is the beauty of liberty. And it's also it's a constant source of anxiety, especially if people aren't, you know, they don't feel comfortable about what's coming next is going to be at least as good, if not better. It's anxiety inducing for a lot of people because they only see the loss or they only see the destruction and not the creation.
Right.
But
I mean, it's always the problem. It's like we talked about before. You'll never know what could have been if you hadn't stopped a certain amount of change from happening. And you're right. Sometimes it'll be worse, but a lot of times it's better. And I think that that's the general gist of, human society, human progress.
I think that's the millennial in you talking, and I like it, but I'm angry that I won't get to share in it to the same extent that you do. Well, we will end it there. We'll leave it there. I've been talking with Kat Murty. She's a social media expert at the Cato Institute. She does their digital projects. You can look her up at cato.org. She's also a board member emeritus at Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, which is a great group, ssdp.org. And she co-founded Feminists for Liberty. Kat, what's the best website? What's the best URL for Feminists for Liberty?
Feminists for Liberty. You can find us on our website, but honestly, you're better off finding us on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, we're just at Feminist Liberty, and just look up Feminists for Liberty on Facebook.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.